Okay, we're back on the record. Mr. Kuntz, you can call your next witness. Or Mr. Sanderson?
Thank you, Your Honor. We'd call Danette Schmidt.
Okay. Ms. Schmidt, before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath, advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both, and being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Schmidt, could you please state your full name and address, please?
Danette Schmidt, 400 North 4th, Bismarck, North Dakota.
And what is your position with MDU?
I'm the Director of Financial Reporting and Planning.
And could you briefly describe your responsibilities in that role?
I'm responsible for any reporting that comes out of the utility, whether it be for utility-specific reporting, SEC reporting for our corporate office, or internal management reporting and analysis. I also do the oversee the financial plan, both the five-year and the one-year forecast.
And could you please describe your educational background?
I have a Bachelor of Science degree in accounting from Morehead State University, and I'm a certified public accountant.
And would you please briefly describe your work experience?
I've been with MDU Family of Companies for 32 years. I started in internal auditing and worked in our corporate office as financial analyst before moving to the utility as an supervisor of financial reporting and planning, and have moved up in that role.
And are you familiar with MDU's application in this present proceeding?
I am.
Now, your pre-filed testimony is marked as MDU Exhibit 4. If asked the same questions as indicated in your pre-filed testimony, would your answers remain the same?
They would.
And can you briefly summarize for the Commission the key points contained in your pre-filed testimony?
My pre-filed testimony covered the financial statements, both A and B, as well as Statement F, the cost of capital component used in the revenue requirement for this proceeding. The revenue requirement we've requested is 7.588%, and that included the 10% ROE as covered by Dr. Gaske. MDU targets a 50-50 debt-to-equity capital ratio, and in trying to cover the financings for our capital investments for our gas business, we will be continuing to achieve the 50-50 ratio in our 2015 projected financings. We are also making every effort to reduce our overall cost of debt, and we have lowered our cost of debt by refinancing essentially all our debt since 2006. And in refinancing, we try to project the different maturity rates in order to mitigate our refinancing risk.
Thank you. I have no further questions, and we tender this witness for cross.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Jernigan?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No questions.
Okay. Commissioner Kalk?
Once again, you guys are all getting paid, right? All right. No, I just have one question. The when you talk about refinancing your long-term debt, which is great, how long does that term go to? I mean, you went from 8.7 to 5.9, but is that like 3 years from now it'll go back up? When you refinance, is it a 20-year deal or a 10-year deal? Or
we try to stagger our maturity rates over 10, 15, 20-year periods in order to achieve the best possible financing, and that also allows us to refinance different rates at different times.
So when do you think when does your exposure really happen again, where if the interest rates go up drastically, will you be exposed immediately every year, or is there some period of time where you're covered because you don't have anything coming due for a while?
It's covered in the exhibit, but it's staggered over the years, so there's not one period where we would be at significant risk for refinancing.
But when's the first time that happens? It happens like today?
2016, we do have some debt coming due, but we are working on refinancing some issues right now.
Okay, thank you. No other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Thank you. Danette, can you tell me about any challenges you had in refinancing? Refinancing
none
that debt?
To my knowledge.
So you were able to get a lower interest rate without any real hassles?
We've
from
been successful in renegotiating our rates, yes.
And then how long generally are those rates from, give me a range of dates that you're kind of locked in at your current debt negotiation?
We have 10-year, 20-year refinancings that we put out last year. So every 5 to 10 years, we would have some issuances that may come due.
Okay.
Depending on the financing needs.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Thanks.
Commissioner Chrisman?
Why wouldn't you be refinancing everything that you could for longer periods of time and take advantage of these low interest rates?
There is a cost to refinancing, obviously. We have issuance costs that need to be rolled into the overall cost of debt, as well as if we call some other debt, we may have to pay premiums to call the old debt.
No other questions.
Mr. Sanderson?
Nothing further.
Okay. Mr. Hsu, anything further?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaufman?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Jernigan?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Commissioners, anything further? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Sanderson, will you be calling the next witness?
Yes, we'd call Travis Jacobson.
Okay. Mr. Jacobson, I'm required to give you the oath, advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter? Okay, go ahead, Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. Mr. Jacobson, could you please state your name and business address?
Travis Jacobson, 400 North 4th Street here in Bismarck.
And what is your position with MDU?
I am the regulatory analysis manager.
And could you briefly describe your responsibilities in that role?
I am responsible for preparation of the cost of service studies, fuel clause adjustments, purchase gas adjustments, and gas tracking adjustments of each of the jurisdictions in which we operate.
And could you describe your educational background?
I have a Bachelor of Science in Accounting degree from Minot State University, as well as a CPA.
Okay. And could you briefly describe your work experience?
Sure. I started with Montana Dakota in 1999 as a financial analyst, and I worked my way through that department, assumed responsibilities for financial planning, and then about a year and a half ago, I accepted the position that I'm currently in.
And are you familiar with MDU's application in this proceeding?
Yes, I am.
Now, you submitted pre-filed direct testimony marked as Exhibit 5 and rebuttal testimony marked as Exhibit 9 in this proceeding. If asked the same questions as indicated in your pre-filed testimony, would your answers remain the same?
Taking into account both my pre-filed as well as my
Mr. rebuttal. Jacobs, I'm sorry. Can you just speak into the mic so it's not picking it up
okay.
entirely? So when you look over at Mr. Sanderson, sometimes it doesn't come
okay.
clear. So go ahead.
When you take into account both my pre-filed and rebuttal testimony, my answers would all remain the same.
And Mr. Jacobson, can you briefly summarize your testimony for the commission?
Sure. In my testimony, I'm sponsoring statements C through E, G through N, and exhibits TRJ 1 and 2. And from a very high level, the pre-filed testimony presented, I presented the natural gas operation for 2013, which provided a rate of return of 5.5%. And from that base, I projected the test year, 2015, showed the return at 5.255%. And that compared to a requested rate of return of 7.588%. The test period, as I said, was based on a projected 2015. That said, my testimony laid out each adjustment to revenue, cost of gas, other O&M expenses, including labor, benefits, subcontract labor, just to name a few, on the income statement and each adjustment on the rate base as well. Based on these parameters, we showed a revenue shortfall of $4.3 million. The main drivers in this revenue shortfall were investments made, along with the associated depreciation and taxes, as well as increased operations and maintenance expenses. Throughout this proceeding, the company has provided updates, as well as the 2014 actual results, to further substantiate the filing. As you're aware, staff and the company reached an agreement, settlement agreement, in the amount of $2.563 million and a return of 7.34%.
Now, Mr. Jacobson, I want to just follow up on a couple issues that were raised earlier, one being Commissioner Fedorchuk earlier asked the cost of gas tariff. Can you please explain what constitutes the cost of gas tariff?
Sure. The cost of gas that we have in this case was based on an estimate at the time of the filing of the flowing gas price and includes all of the pipeline and transportation charges that also go into that cost of gas. There is no Montana-Dakota-owned infrastructure or other items within that. And again, the 71% that was talked about earlier, that's just strictly the cost of gas, what we're paying for it and we're delivering to the customer. And that is what the customer has control over when it comes to conservation on their end.
Now, Mr. Jacobson, Commissioner Chrisman earlier asked about the Mandantown Border Station. Can you explain the cost of allocation for the Mandantown Border Station?
Sure. In this case, we had a capital project for a little less than $400,000 that was the beginning of a project to get gas to the north side of Mandan to provide for reliability and capacity increases in that area. And kind of to back up just a little bit on the pipeline itself, there was a pipeline that was constructed to serve the Heskett Station. And that pipeline was sized with a little excess capacity so that we had this opportunity. So in this case, the project for the town border station would be entirely bore by the customers of Montana Dakota. We have also taken a small piece of that capacity, of the excess capacity of that pipe, and included that part of the revenue requirement of that pipe itself to be bore by the customers of Montana Dakota through a credit to the electric company for that pipeline.
And finally, earlier Commissioner Fedorchuk raised the issue of the pension and retirement expenses. Can you explain those expenses as part of the settlement agreement?
Sure. What we have traditionally done and accepted generally across all of our service territory, we go out through an actuary, and Ann mentioned that the pension was frozen. However, there are costs to maintaining the pension for existing employees, and there are a number of existing employees receiving pension benefits. To the extent that the returns on the assets in that pension fund do not earn a return sufficient to maintain that pension fund and cover the costs of those payments to the retirees, there is a cost to that. Because it's frozen, and in most recent years, the cost has been relatively low. As Mr. Shook pointed out in his testimony, it does tend to fluctuate. So that was the attempt in that adjustment, was to alleviate that fluctuation of that pension cost within the case.
Thank you. I have no further questions at this time. We tender the witness for cross.
Okay. Mr. Shue?
Just one question. I remember in your testimony, and I think also in the exhibits, Mr. Shook brought this out, that there, as of next year's forecast, it was going to fluctuate up, and it seems substantially higher than past year's fluctuations. What was the reason for that?
I guess there's a combination of reasons. Fund performance relative to the required performance of that. The discount rate that's used can affect that calculation. And then any updates in the mortality tables or the population of the pension recipients can change that as well. And that's updated each year. And then, again, it kind of goes back to how that fund performs, and then that performance is smoothed to the extent within the actuary's estimates.
Nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Mr. Jernigan?
Just one quick question. Commissioner Kalk is looking for some questions from us. Do you have the settlement agreement in front of you?
Is that exhibit?
Yeah, exhibit 11.
I do.
The first paragraph there, roughly midway down the sentence, it says that this settlement agreement, if accepted, will result in a manner consistent with public interest and result in just and reasonable rates for the customer's retail gas operations in North Dakota. Do you agree with that statement?
In the context of the settlement?
Yes.
I would say yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
We have no questions. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Kalk?
Since we've had such good questions, I don't have any, so I'm good.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Well, good. Now I get Brian's time, too.
You'll my time.
Travis, you remind me of Darcy. Your demeanor and your tone of voice and everything. I'll let you guys decide that, but I almost wonder if you're related. Oh, that is good. He's a smart guy. All right. A couple questions, and I want to have you walk through some of the charts that you included in your direct test or your pre-filed testimony. So I appreciate the cost of gas tariff explanation. But I'm going to have you go through it again more slowly. So it includes the cost of gas. How often does this tariff fluctuate? Is it daily? Is it recalculated every day, or as the price of gas fluctuates, or is it set for a month?
Yep, we submit a new PGA tariff every month.
Okay.
If the change is more than 10 cents from the prior period.
Okay, and tell me again what goes into the calculation for that tariff.
Okay, so what we do is we put in there the cost of the flowing gas.
Okay.
The cost of the pipeline. So in order to serve our customers on the peak demand day, we have to contract with the pipelines for capacity sufficient to meet that need. So that cost then becomes part of our per unit cost of gas that we charge our customer. As you're likely aware, we have a storage field,
mm-hmm.
and we use that as a price hedge as well as a deliverability hedge for certain areas within our system. And so the cost of gas that goes into storage, comes out of storage, as well as any charges while it's in storage, those costs then are all part of that calculation, as well as the return on the storage to the extent we have that in the ground.
The cost of the pipeline, who owns the pipeline?
We contract through a few different ones. The majority of our gas is transported through Williston Basin's WBI Energy Transmission Company. And we charge the customer the posted FERC tariff that WBI is granted.
So FERC sets a tariff that WBI can charge, and you pass that cost through to customers. Do you make anything? Do you make any profit at all on this cost of gas? Is it strictly what you're paying for the gas and the pipeline charges is what the customers pay?
Yes. Now, Mike Diller did point out in his direct testimony that there was a loss factor.
Right.
So that could create a small difference in depending if the loss is more or less than the 0.45% loss factor that's established in the rates.
And then the cost of taking the gas from the WBI pipeline to your customers, those are all costs that we're looking at in this rate case.
Right. The cost of the gas that we include is the cost delivered to the town border station.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it is the fixed costs that Montana Dakota incurs to get it from the town border station to that home, to that business.
And does WBI deliver it to every town border station?
I believe I believe just about everyone. I guess I'm not sure I have a 100% certainty on that. But.
So, okay, now on the pension and retirement expenses, again, that's helpful to understand. Can you tell me a little bit more about how many employees do you have in the withdrawing from the pension system?
I don't have that number right off the top of my
head. Is it a majority of the employees? Probably. Oh, no. Well.
Well, no current employees.
And then there's some who are employees, like some of you, since you were employed before 2010, probably are eligible still.
We would be eligible for a pension, but it's at a frozen amount that was set back in 2010 when it was frozen.
All right.
So there's no incremental cost to that because those benefits were expensed up to that time.
Okay. How have you done any estimates on how long you expect to have to be paying out in the existing pension system, not the frozen, to the people who will qualify for the benefits that are frozen? So, like, existing retirees who are drawing from it?
For instance, myself, if I retire after 55, I will get a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be the remainder of my life.
But you said those costs aren't going to fluctuate. They're set.
They won't fluctuate. But so to the extent that they have to pay out X number of dollars each month for my retirement benefit,
mm-hmm.
if that fund of assets
I see.
Doesn't earn a return sufficient to make that payment, then there would be an expense at that time.
I see.
Or again, I mentioned, you know, if the average age of the retiree were to increase over time,
mm-hmm.
then that becomes an update then to the amount of expense that we would estimate.
Right. Okay, so you said that the way it's dealt with in the settlement attempts to kind of alleviate some of this fluctuation.
That's correct.
But you're still going to have the fluctuation, so how are you accounting for it, and how will that come to – how will we see that in future rate cases?
And I guess that's there's a statement in the – I believe it's on page 4 under bullet point 2. It says in here, an order approving this settlement shall be considered as an accounting order for future rate and account treatment of these accounts. So I guess what my interpretation of that is at the time of the next rate case,
mm-hmm.
we would seek to address a resolution of the amount that hasn't been recorded.
Okay.
And even at that time then, if it was a positive balance or a negative balance, what you would do is you would set an equal amount. There again, what you're doing is you're creating that levelized expense. So there isn't a fluctuation. And if we happen to pick a test period or a base period where that expense is high, you have that ability to collect that then in future periods, or on the contrary, if you selected a period when it was extremely low, you know, you can have this benefit or a hit to the company or the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And that I guess that was kind of the ideology behind setting that at a set amount.
Right. All right. Okay, so I'm mostly interested, and I realize there's agreement on the revenues in the settlement. But so I understand how you guys calculated. I would like to take a little bit of time going through some of these charts. And you gave a nice little summary at the beginning of your testimony with Dan, asking you questions, going through some of your statements in statement M. But could you go through some of these charts and say, okay, here's what we're estimating for revenues, here's what we're looking at for expenses, and here's how we came up with our our revenue requirement? And maybe there's one of these that kind of lays that all out, but I couldn't find it.
I'll go right to the end first.
Okay.
Statement L, page 3 of 3. And really what this statement L does is it, the page 3 of 3, that is where the calculation of this revenue shortfall takes place.
Okay.
So then if you go to statement M, page 1, the first column on page L agrees to the last column, or the column on the right, on page M.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're looking at then page 1 of statement M, you'll see the revenue, you know, goes up from 107 to 125,000. But on the other side of that, what Montana Dakota would term is margin is really your sales.
Didn't you mean expenses go up 107 to 125?
And your cost of gas. That's really what we derive margin from.
Mm.
So those are the, while it looks as though our revenue has went up substantially, you know, the other side of that is your cost of gas has gone up as well. That said, there is an increase in margin. We have seen an increase in our sales, and in as a part of this settlement, increases in revenue were also recognized, which is part of that difference of how we got from 4.3 million to 2.6.
Okay.
I guess, you know, each one of these statements, and there's a lot of them, kind of expand on, you know, specific adjustments. And without getting too far off track, I guess I would answer or attempt to answer any particular question.
Is there a chart with the settlement agreement that shows all the adjustments to the revenue requirement and how you went from 4.3 to the current 2.3?
I don't know that there's a chart specifically. I think in Victor's testimony, he does have all of his recommended changes,
right,
in a chart.
But then they kind of
they weren't all agreed to.
Went down to 1.3 or something,
right?
And then I guess I'd like to follow that better, so I know what areas you guys adjusted and can better understand that and what, you know, what's changed.
Okay.
And I don't know, maybe advocacy has that coming up.
Commissioner, I do believe that Mr. Shook will be speaking to that today.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Okay. I think that concludes my questions. Thank you, Travis.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Chrisman?
I'm still looking for a little more clarity on the 71%.
Okay.
Is that based on just $1 amount for gas that you chose to use as the example, or it, 1 month when it was at a certain rate? Or
what we did in getting to that 71%, at the time that we filed this, we looked at the gas prices for the year of 2015. So if we were to redo that today, that cost of gas would probably be about a dollar lower. And obviously that would change your percentages because your distribution piece that's in that calculation of 71% would change. So that cost of gas changes nearly every month. If it's less than 10%, 10 cents, we don't file. But last year, I think we filed nearly every month, and the change was 10 cents or more.
So when you filed the original case, you were looking at, like, what contract prices were for each month throughout 2015.
That's right.
And that's what you based it on.
Yep.
Okay. And then, and I didn't bring it now, so I can't quote off it. I left it laying over in my office. I brought my bill from one time earlier this month. Okay. And, of course, it doesn't follow a calendar month. Is everyone in a town or a region all on the same ending day, or are they staggered all throughout the month?
I think it depends on a number of things. One is the size of the town. If it's a very small town, both of them might be on the same day. Or you go to Bismarck, and just the logistics of it, it's going to require a number of different days to get the readings.
Okay. So on mine, there were like 20 days at this price and 10 days at a different price.
Right.
And so then someone else's might be 19 and 11. And does the computer just take care of that and that's really no additional trouble? Or it seems like there has to be an enormous amount of record keeping and accounting in order to keep this so close each and every month as opposed to going throughout the year and then having an adjustment.
And I think it's essentially a mathematical equation on the part of our customer information system. So they take and look at the read date, the prior read date, and it's mathematic. It was 15 days, and 15 days I take 50% of my usage.
So having this level of precision isn't costing the company a great deal of money to keep track of?
No.
Is that what you're saying? Okay. And lastly, these graphs on the settlement agreement that show the revenue increase or decrease and the percentages, are you the one to explain those numbers or someone else?
What is that on?
In the settlement agreement.
Page 5.
On page 5 and on page 2 are the original proposal and the settlement proposal.
Commissioner, that would probably be Tammy.
Okay. I'll wait for her then, and I have no more questions. Thanks, Travis.
Mr. Sanderson, any
follow-up? Nothing further.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Mr. Jernigan?
Questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No questions. Okay.
Commissioners, any? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jacobson.
Your Honor, as our final witness, we would call Tammy Aberle.
Okay. And Ms. Aberle, I need to give you the oath, advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It is a Class C felony, punishable by maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay.
Ms. Aberle, would you please state your name and business address?
My name is Tammy A. Aberle. My business address is 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck, North Dakota.
And you're employed by Montana Dakota Utilities?
Yes, I am.
And what's your position with Montana Dakota?
I am the Director of Regulatory Affairs.
And how long have you worked for the company?
I've been with Montana Dakota for 32 years in the regulatory area.
What are your responsibilities in your current position?
Today, I'm responsible for implementing objectives and policies with regard to pricing, rate structures, cost of service, and adjustment mechanisms.
You're familiar with the company's application in this proceeding?
Yes, I am.
And did you file direct testimony in this case?
Yes, I did.
And you're also adopting the testimony of another witness, are you not?
Yes, I am.
And I'm showing you what's been marked as MDU Exhibit Number 7. Can you identify that exhibit, please?
Yes. MDU 7 is my pre-filed direct testimony. As you move through that, my exhibits are attached to my testimony. There is a pink divider sheet in the exhibit books that have been handed out, and that is the testimony that I adopted on July 29th of Sarah Cardwell.
So you're presenting both your direct testimony as well as that of Sarah Cardwell, is that correct?
Correct.
Do you have any changes or additions to either piece of that testimony?
I do have one change, and that change is on page 8 of the testimony behind the pink divider sheet. So it would be the testimony that I adopted. On page 8, on page, and these changes have been marked in the books that have been distributed. On line 13, the 50% should be changed to 62%. And on line 17, the 50% should be changed to 38%.
Did you also submit pre-file rebuttal testimony in this case?
Yes, I did.
And showing what you, what has been marked as MDU Exhibit 10, do you identify that for the commission, please?
MDU Exhibit 10 is my pre-filed rebuttal testimony.
Do you have any corrections or additions to that testimony?
I do not.
If I were to ask you the questions that are shown in MDU Exhibit 7 and MDU Exhibit 10, would your answers be the same today as they're shown in those written documents?
Yes, except for the change that I noted in Exhibit 7.
Could you, you've also prepared a PowerPoint presentation, I believe, in connection with summarizing your testimony, is that right?
Yes, I have.
And at this time, would you please provide a summary of your pre-filed testimony referencing your PowerPoint presentation as MDU Exhibit 13?
Yes, I will. So I'll provide an overview of my testimony. That testimony included the volume and revenue projections underlying the rate case, the embedded class cost of service study, and rate design proposed in this case, including any tariff modifications. The projected 2015 customers and volumes were developed based on actual 2014 customers and normalized use per customer. We looked at a growth factor and applied that growth factor to get to projected 2015 volumes. For the residential class, that growth in customers was estimated at 3.4%, and firm general, small firm general, which I'll refer to in the future, and our differentiation between small and large firm general is based on the meter that's in place to serve that customer. So the small would be less than 500 cubic feet per hour, and the large is over that. As part of the settlement, we agreed in looking at updated projections and, updated actual numbers, we agreed with Mr. Deller's recommendation that the large firm general service class should have been increased as well. So we reflected the increase proposed by Mr. Diller, which was an additional 299 customers or about 500,000 DK to that large firm general class based on actual data. We also, as part of that settlement agreement, which affected the revenues or what we call margin, that which is what this case is about, the revenues less the cost of gas, we also increased the margins that we were going to be collecting from the small interruptible class because we moved the current market differential rate that's in place for that group. And we moved that revenue into the rate case. So it offset what we needed under the rate case. And the combination of those two was approximately an increase in margin of $800,000. So that was a good part of what reduced the amount of revenues that we needed under this rate case. Now, looking at the embedded class cost of service study and the chart up on the screen at this time, or the second slide, is just a summary of what I discussed. The projected 2015 are the volumes and the customers that we agreed to in the settlement agreements. And along in the middle is the percentage increase that we agreed to in the settlement agreement. And the, really what the class cost of service study provides for us are those last three columns, the return on rate base. So we essentially take the statement M that Travis just recently referred to, that revenue requirement statement, and we take that revenue requirement and allocate it to each of the revenue rate classes in order to determine how that rate particular rate class is contributing to the overall return. So as you can see here, as filed, we had the residential class based on our rate case, was producing a return of 3.4%. Under the settlement agreement, we did agree to change the allocation of distribution mains so that that allocator was 100% demand related. That change in an allocation factor had the effect of moving costs away from the residential class or the smaller use customers and over to the larger use customers. As you can see on the left side, the majority of the system is there to serve residential customers. Almost 86% of our customer base is residential. So once we removed that customer component, it had the tendency to move costs over to the interruptible or larger users using classes because they have it's only looking at the distribution demand costs at this point. So that settlement return, it went up both because of that change in allocation and also because of the reduction in the revenue requirement. The final column there shows what the residential class would be producing on average with the revenue increase that we have allocated to the residential class. That would be true for each of the customer classes shown in this schedule. So based on that embedded class cost of service study, we then looked at the percentage increase required from each class. And in doing so, we first held the small interruptible as part of the settlement agreement to the increase we originally proposed, which was a 6.8% increase in revenues. That class is producing less than the average increase, so we proposed to increase those revenues by 6.8%. And as also part of the settlement agreement, we agreed to the decrease in the Air Force class of 1.6%. That left the remainder of the increase to be recovered from the residential class that was less than the overall return, resulting in that increase as shown of $3.3 million. The firm general service class was producing average return. We did not propose an increase there. And the large interruptible class, which is a rather unique group. We have seven customers in that class. There's one customer that's probably well over 50% of that class. Those large IT customers are typically located very close to the main line or the interstate pipeline companies. We typically have very little investment associated with serving those customers. And again, they're providing a return above the average, so we did not propose an increase to the large IT group. The next step in the process of collecting the revenue requirement, so once we've decided overall what we need and then what do we need from each class of customers, is to move into the rate design portion of the process. So once we had determined that the residential class would be allocated an increase of 3.3%, we need to look at how will we collect those revenues from that class. As has been discussed earlier, we are proposing to move forward with a total fixed cost recovery of the distribution-related costs. The slide up at this time shows what those costs are on a current basis. Today, we're collecting about 50 cents a day for our basic service charge, and 32.6 cents is recovered on a volumetric basis. As shown, again, the cost of gas utilized in this case was $5.582 to be exact. That cost of gas is the same under any scenario because it does not affect the amount of the increase we are requesting today. Customers are paying an interim rate today. On April 7th, we implemented interim rates. Interim rates are applied on a equal basis so that there's no change in the rate design from the prior case. So effectively, we increase each component the same under each rate schedule. So the rate that residential customers are paying today is about 56 cents per day. The distribution delivery also went up because, again, we increased each component. So on an average basis, the residential customers were, if these interim rates would stay in for a year, would pay approximately $2.38 per month more. And on the far right is the settlement rates that we are proposing to implement, and that results in a daily basic service charge of approximately 64 cents. We've removed the distribution delivery charge, so that is a reduction for every decatherm of gas that is delivered. They would no longer be paying that charge. So the monthly fixed cost goes up to $19.60 per month. The average increase actually drops because we have removed that distribution delivery charge or that volumetric charge. Again, these are on the on an average customer basis. I'm going to just kind of show some additional as we dig into the focusing on the residential bill. This is what what our typical residential bill looks like or customer looks like. On average, they're using 94 decatherms a year. You'll see the seasonality of that gas usage because most of our natural gas customers are using gas for heating purposes. So we're showing the present rate, and at that column, that is pre-rate case rate, if you will, or taking the interim out of this equation. So that present rate is what was authorized out of the last rate case. The proposed rate is the settlement rate. So, again, you see that customers in those higher use months will actually see a small decrease in their bills when they're paying more for their heating costs because we're not recovering that fixed cost on a volumetric basis. You'll see the highest increases that will occur in the summer months when their bills are naturally the lowest, but that is showing what the effect of that fixed charge is on a monthly basis for an average customer. I have one more view of a residential bill. We'll dig down just one more step further, and this would be really what a customer would see on their bill. As Commissioner Christman said, they will see, because of our billing, that cost of gas maybe be split across 2 months. But a customer will see their basic service charge. They'll see a distribution delivery component, which is based on, again, on the volumes delivered in that particular month, the cost of gas, and then the total bill. Under the proposed settlement rates, you see the basic service charge increase, and on average, that increase is $4.58 a month. That increase then is offset by that distribution delivery component going to zero. And so there is an offset of $2.55, getting back to, again, that average monthly increase that we've talked about of $2.03. A little bit of rounding going on there. Finally, this slide, and is also this slide is also provided separately as MDU Exhibit 14, which is, I guess, our interpretation of the request to show, you know, what is the effect of the increase on varying levels of consumption. So on this particular slide, we included zero. There are some customers out there that, you know, if we look at a particular point in time, have used zero gas, but they have a gas service line there, and it's available to serve them. We also then just took 50% of the average use or chose 48 DK as an annual bill and then went 50% above the average or 140 decatherms. So and going across here, the annual DK is shown on the far left. The cost of gas is the next column. Again, that cost of gas is unchanged with the rate case. So that would apply in each of the scenarios, if you will, as filed, pre-case, settlement, because, again, that cost of gas, as Travis explain is that's the pass-through, and it is a combination of pipeline charges and the commodity itself. But it's that cost that we pick up at the town border station and that we then deliver into the customer. So on distribution charges, you can see on a pre-case basis, so this would have been the rates authorized in the last rate case, the zero use, which is that basic service charge that was approved, is $180. That increased to $204 on an interim basis. As filed, we had proposed to increase that to $253. As in the case, we had a higher revenue requirement, and we also had originally proposed an increase of 5.8% to the residentials. So that $253 was what we had filed. As part of this settlement, with the reduction in the revenue requirement and the reduction in the amount allocated to the residentials, that would drop to $235. On the next set of numbers is the total bill. So again, on a zero line, you'll see that those two would be the same, because on the total, I've simply added in the cost of gas, because that is what the customers would be paying. And on the very far right are the total costs that would have, if we would have simply taken the costs out of the embedded cost study, that would have been the cost. So a little bit higher as well. We didn't move residentials all the way to the average return. As you can see by this graph, the zero-use customer is paying $235.17 for their distribution delivery, as is every other customer. That fixed cost truly remains fixed. However, when you look at the total bill, the higher-use customers continue to pay a significantly higher amount each month because, as they should, they're using a significant amount more in gas costs. So that column, the cost of gas column, which on average represents 71% of a bill on average. It, as noted, gas costs are lower today at this point in time. It's still in a range between that 69, 70 some percent of their bill. That provides the opportunity for customers to conserve. They can reduce one decatherm of usage at their home for however they do it, reduce the temperature, get a new thermostat, whatever method that they use, they will reduce their costs in this example by $5.58 for every decatherm that they can do so. So I think, you know, this shows, again, there is significant value in conservation, and this rate structure does not disrupt that. The cost of gas is the natural resource that we want to maintain, and that we should provide a price signal to customers. This is what we can avoid if you take actions. We can avoid the pipe in the ground. We can avoid buying that gas for you, and we can avoid contracting on the interstate pipeline for capacity to get that gas to the town border station. So I believe that the rate structure that's proposed as part of this settlement, again, does not discourage conservation. It does provide revenue stability to the company, which is important in, as we've discussed, in maintaining that distribution system. So there's really three things that affect our recovery of those costs, and that is conservation, weather. Weather's colder or warmer than normal. If it's colder than normal, we're going to over-recover those distribution costs. If it's warmer than normal, we'll under-recover. And it also addresses the seasonality of the gas system. We need to be there and ready to serve that coldest day. But again, those costs do not change. They do not vary by the amount of gas moving through that pipeline system at that particular point in time. So I think, as shown in an earlier slide, while not significant dollars. It does show a decrease in those higher use months and really moves that to the summer when their customer bills are lower anyway, just because of less use, less cost of gas. Montana, Dakota did also propose to implement a rate stabilization mechanism, and as noted, we have that has been withdrawn as part of the rate case, and we continue to look at potentially targeting that more narrowly to pipeline safety or integrity, but that would be another day, a different application. So that concludes my summary.
Thank you, Ms. Averly. There's been some questions throughout the hearing that probably best relate to your testimony, and I'll ask these questions around those, and please try to answer them the best you can. First of all, before we get to those, though, there was a reference in Mr. Collins' testimony exhibits to two Air Force classes or rates, and the settlement document that was just referenced only shows one Air Force rate. Can you explain how the Air Force is charged for natural gas service under MDU's tariffs and what's the difference between the types of service and how the settlement will be applied to those services?
Yes, I can do that. The Air Force installation at Minot, we serve that entire base as a what I'm going to again refer to as a mainline or a transmission level customer. We have some facilities coming off of WBI Energy's pipeline to deliver gas into that system. And until approximately 2008, the Air Force owned their entire distribution system. So we're the Rate 64 schedule that has been in place for many years is that delivery cost. So we're taking that gas that's being delivered on behalf of the Air Force. They are now a sales interruptible sales customer of ours, so we're purchasing the gas on their behalf and delivering it to that town border station serving all of the load within the air base. And there are varying loads within that base. There are residential housing for service personnel. There's businesses within that system. But the charge and the rate that we're referring to here that we're proposing to decrease is that charge for delivering gas to the border station. The Air Force, while they have privatized the distribution system, and that's the other rate, the Rate 65. And I think it was approximately 2008. We purchased the distribution system from the Air Force. So the other rate, the contract rate, is really the operation and maintenance expenses associated with that base. But it didn't change how we were delivering gas to them, and it didn't change how the base was, at this point in time, how they're divvying up that utility bill. So our customer at this point in time is a Minot Air Force Base. We deliver it on an interruptible rate for the most part, majority of their load. They have a propane peaking system on that base, and so if we call on them to interrupt, even if it is a residential customer, they're actually providing service to those customers within the base.
There was a question about other air bases. Are there other air bases located on Montana Dakota systems outside of North Dakota?
Montana Dakota does serve the Ellsworth Air Force Base and near Rapid City.
And how is the treatment that the company is proposing, the rate treatment that the company is proposing in this rate case, compare to what the rates that are charged at the Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota?
Ellsworth is a bit different. Ellsworth, in the last several years as well, privatized their system, but they've handled that a bit differently. We've actually added another delivery point to serve Ellsworth. So in the last rate case in South Dakota, and which was 2012, we actually moved that airbase installation in with our large interruptible class. They're more like the large interruptible and less unique than Minot is today. So there are some differences in how those bases are served.
There was a question that what's the difference between a small versus a large interruptible customer I believe you touched on that with respect to the firm customer class. Can you? Is the same distinction applied to interruptible customers, or is there a different distinction for interruptible?
On the interruptible side, our tariffs are, we classify customers based on annual usage, and the small interruptible are those customers 100,000 DK and less. In the large interruptible class, then, are greater than that. And as I noted, most there's a two or three in that group that are significantly more than that amount.
And I believe you testified as something like a total of six large interruptible customers on the North Dakota system?
Seven, actually.
Seven.
Yeah.
And from a comparison standpoint, how many small interruptible customers would the company have in North Dakota?
I believe we have approximately 200.
Okay. Yes. There was Commissioner Christman asked at the beginning of the case as to the evolution of the distribution charge as to, you know, how did it get to be in the rates, and are we proposing to eliminate it today, and are we going to bring it back tomorrow? Can you give, based upon your history with the company, can you explain your understanding of the evolution of the distribution charge and how we got to where we are today and the progression of where you see charges going in the future?
Sure. I think, you know, if we look back to, even if we just look at Montana-Dakota Utilities, pre-1985, Montana-Dakota included all of the WBI energy facilities. We were one entity, and so the cost of, there was no differentiation between cost of gas and distribution. We were one company, much like a vertically integrated electric company is today. And so as that evolution occurred throughout the nation, the deregulation of gas itself really took the distribution, took the gas company and split it between distribution companies or local distribution company, as Montana Dakota is referred to as, and the pipeline was spun off as a separate entity. So back in those early days, and even prior to that, it was just one bundled cost. There was, you didn't really, you came into a rate case and you were determining what that cost of gas was going to be. You were determining what all the costs were to get that from the wellhead all the way to the customer. So now that we've narrowed that down, and as time has gone by and working with staff, it became apparent that now it was much easier and we hoped a much better signal to customers to be able to show just what is the cost of gas so that you knew what you would be able to save and conserve. What's the, and again, if we don't have to look back too far to remember the volatility in that cost of gas component. So it really laid out, this is the piece. When you see your bill go up, it's really that pass-through or that amount that we had to pay to get the gas to you. In those early times, the basic service charge, it's been called a base rate, a customer charge, really started out on, as a very low level as an industry. And I think that it's just as this has evolved, we're looking closer at narrowing that review down to distribution costs, recognizing those are fixed costs, and making the move to move it into a fixed charge, much like the pipeline companies. If you know, FERC is the federal commission, really looks at if you've got a pipeline in place, a straight fixed variable charge is a better way to price that product. And so this is really just a continuation of that. If we were successful in moving to a total fixed charge rate, I would see no reason to bring back a volumetric charge. I see no reason that at some point in time we would have variable costs on the distribution system that would cause us to look for a volumetric charge to collect those costs.
So all the questions I have of this witness, we tender for cross-examination.
Yeah. Mr. Hsu?
Mr. Hunter. So right now the interim rate has been set at 3.4% across all classes, correct?
Effectively, we increase each component of that, of the each rate. So that's why you see the differences, you know, even the distribution delivery charge increased.
Right. So every class should be seeing a refund if the settlement is approved, aside from the small interruptible class, correct?
Actually, we're collecting from every class. And so what we, the way the interim refunds would work is we would look at what did we collect in total more than we should have. Because if you look at just rate design, the interim refund wouldn't go back the way that it should. So we'll look at the total dollars that we collected above what we should have had we implemented an interim rate of $2.6 million. Okay. And so we'll reduce everyone that we collected interim dollars from will receive a refund.
I see. Going forward then, after the, if the settlement is approved, every class should see a decrease in rates aside from the small interruptibles.
Correct.
Correct.
Yes.
You said the average user, the variable fuel charge that they have, if the proposed settlement is approved, will be at 71% for the average user. Is that right?
Yes.
And you gave a range as well earlier. It was like 69 to something other percent.
And that is if as that cost of gas changes, you know, so if the cost of gas goes down, as it is lower today. You know, what we're passing on to customers right now this month is lower than that 558. So that percentage would decrease somewhat. But on the flip side, if it goes up, which isn't unheard of, above the 558, that will it's going to vary in that range.
No further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Ms. Aberle.
Good afternoon.
I'm John Kaufman, representing AARP, and I do have a few questions for you about your testimony and the schedules and your calculations, but first I'd like to ask you about this schedule that is Exhibit 14.
Okay.
It's up on the board. We can just leave that up if you would. I'd like to ask you some questions about the magnitude of the way that the rate design proposal would impact different sized customers within the residential class. And I wanted to know maybe a little bit more about how you picked these. You did say that you picked 94 decatherms as an average amount. Now, is that the median or the mean, or is that a good rule of thumb?
It's a simple average of our entire customer base based on a normalized test here.
Did you perform any sort of distribution analysis to see where there might be a collection of usages or where the median usage might fall and so forth?
We do look at how varying consumption levels are affected. Yes.
And do you know where the median usage might be?
It is right around the 94 decatherms.
And is it a smooth curve, or is there more usage? Is there a cluster of usage at the low end, or?
No, I believe most of our customers again are heating service customers. We see a few on the outer end of that range, some larger customers, but. For the most part, the majority of the increase is centered around this average.
Do you have you done an analysis or have an idea of where different types of homes might fall? For instance, someone who lives in a small apartment might fall as far as their usage?
I do not have demographic data on our customer base, specifically. However, especially in this area or in our service area, the majority of the apartments are served under a master meter. Mm-hmm. So we're not serving, it would be very few customers we would be providing natural gas service to for an individual apartment building.
Okay. But if they were perhaps four units in one building, would that be master metered?
Most times we do see those master metered. Again, I don't have data that I could, based on square footage of homes we serve, we do not have that demographic data.
You mentioned that there was, perhaps I heard you say that there was a cluster of maybe on the high end of maybe large homes that
Those aren't necessarily large homes. They have high use for a number of reasons. I mean, there are a few on that outer edge. Mm-hmm. end of that range. But again, I couldn't say that they're large homes. They're a large user.
Right. And would you agree with me that under the proposal to go to one big fixed charge, that the increase would more dramatically impact small users as opposed to large users?
The numbers would certainly show that if you looked at a percentage increase. Yes. But as we've said, it's on average, it's $2.04. Mm-hmm. On a maximum, it's $4.55. So on the slide that I showed, the basic service charge and the distribution delivery split out, you'll see a decrease in that bill for, again, under the distribution delivery. But the maximum increase, and I don't have these pages numbered, but on this slide shows that the maximum increase any residential customer would see under this proposal would be $4 and would be the approximately $4.55.
And that is maximum because that's the because that would be someone with zero usage? Yeah.
Well, I believe I just misspoke. It's a little bit different. It's about... It's essentially that.
For someone with zero usage.
Zero usage, okay. Yes.
But you would agree with me that the smaller your usage, the greater the percentage increase will be at the end of this.
The percentage will. The dollar will not be.
Right. Good.
But the percentage, the math will show that the percentage is.
I just did a little calculations myself with percentages, because I'm not good with math. Could you confirm for me what the percentages are on each of these? Back to your Exhibit 14. On each of those four usage levels, under the now I'm just looking at the distribution charge for now. So from the pre-case of the $180 that customers have been paying to the settlement amount of $235.17, that would be a 30.5% rate increase. Is that about right?
Subject to check, I would say yes.
And then moving down to the 48 decatherm usage, my calculation is that the increase for distribution charges would be a 20.1% increase.
Subject.
Does that sound right? And then at the average of 94 decatherms, I have about an 11.5%. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And then at 140 decatherms, the settlement would increase the distribution charges by 4.1%.
Just yes.
Great. And then looking at the total bill, adding in the gas costs, which are not at issue here today or not on this case, I got percentages at zero usage of 32.9% rate increase for someone with no usage. 9.4% for someone using 48 decatherms, about 3.9% at the average, and I don't know if that matches up with your number or not. But then at 140 decatherms, I got that the total increase per settlement would be only 1.3% increase in the bill. Is that about the magnitude that we're talking about?
Yeah, I believe the average is 3.3, but...
Okay. So we'll call that 3.3. But if you use 50% less than the average, your increase is going to be getting closer to 10%. And if you use 50% more than the average person, it'll only be about a 1% rate increase.
If you're
overall.
Looking again at percentages, if you look at the actual dollars, mm-hmm. and you look at the, but yes, the increases are the total dollars you're dividing by are less, so the percentage increase will be more.
And you didn't do any studies, demographic studies, based on income, did you?
We did not.
Right. And so we really don't know what, where we can't draw any conclusions based on the record as far as income level.
I cannot. No.
So all we really know is that low users will pay a higher percentage and high users will pay a lesser percentage. In your direct testimony, and I'm looking at page 5 now, You argue that going to just one fixed charge would send the correct price signal, as distribution costs are primarily fixed in nature. I'll wait till you get there.
Yes.
Page five. Now, you use the word primarily because distribution costs are not 100% fixed, right?
They are not.
Right. And, in fact, when you do your class cost of service study, you allocate costs based on things other than just customer numbers, right? You use, there's demand and energy categories that you allocate costs to.
Yes.
Right. And I, since you have adopted Sarah Caldwell's testimony, could I, you're familiar with her exhibits and so forth?
Yes.
And I guess they're now your exhibits.
Right? Yes.
Could I, let's see. I'd like to direct you to statement O, I guess in the letter O. There's 36 pages there, I think, that comprise the class cost of service study, that the embedded class cost of service study that MDU performed?
Yes.
I'll wait for you to find that statement O. And I'm only going to ask you about the first page of that, if you can get to that. So.
Okay.
Okay, do you have that? Okay. And this says embedded class cost of service study, cost of service by component, projected 2015.
Correct.
And there are different columns there under the heading of residential. And the three columns are demand, energy, and customer. Correct?
Yes.
And if I directed you down there to, it's almost to the bottom, the line that is called net distribution cost of service. Now, when I'm looking at those numbers in those lines, I assume that I'm looking at those are in thousands of dollars, right? So that,
correct.
I know there wasn't, you know, usually there's a 000 in parentheses at the top, but I assume we're looking at millions, right. So total North Dakota residential cost would be about $37,713,000. Is that?
It's a total North Dakota.
Total North Dakota, and then cost that MDU study identified as demand-related are about $5,955,000, would that?
Correct.
And then the energy cost would only be about $250,000. Correct. And then customer costs at about $18,033,000, is that correct? So is that a rough suggestion that $6 million of the costs that are serving the customer are demand-related?
They're capacity related. Mm-hmm. They're fixed costs. They're associated again with the pipeline in the system. Customer is a takeoff. Customer is really looking more just at the service line and the more direct costs. But the entire system is there to serve 86% of our customers, which are
they're
the
not
residentials.
But they wouldn't necessarily be costs that would be equally attributable to each customer. And some customers have a higher demand than others.
We look at the demand of each class and the design day of each of those classes in allocating those costs.
And do you have at your ready the work papers that are behind this?
I did not bring those with me.
I have a copy if I.
Okay. All right.
Okay, yeah, I'll just give you mine if you don't.
What is it?
It is a work paper that was filed in the case. It was filed publicly as work papers to the.
You know what? Like, is there a docket entry on it? Do you know, or
I don't
these
have.
These would have been discovery responses that wouldn't have been filed.
Right. I thought they were filed on the. I thought I found them online on the as work papers filed in the system. But
are they part of the work papers from the application?
Yes. Yes, they correct. They are work papers. They were filed
number one or two
at the same time that the direct testimony was filed. So they're listed there, and just the first, I think, four pages there list the different allocation factors.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a variety of different kinds of costs, and each of them are assigned as either customer-related, demand-related, or energy-related, and most of them have more than one. They might be customer and demand or customer energy and demand related. And so I counted 40 different categories of costs there, what do you call them? Customer or cost components, or I don't know what you, what do you call each one of those?
These are the allocation factors that were determined and used in the class study.
So I know that, I guess.
Honor.
Hang on. Go ahead, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
I'm going to interrupt for 1 minute, and that is, can we identify, I mean, the docket number is probably one or two, but can we identify what some others, more specific,
so
people can find this page number or exhibit number or whatever?
So is it part of the application, or what are we looking at here?
It will be a piece part of the application, but the application is huge. So we need to try to use, use the mic.
A separate line identification on the list of documents in the docket listed as MDU work papers. And this particular document I'm referring her to has sort of a handwritten page number 0-1, 0-2, 0-3 on it.
It's, Your Honor, it's docket number 9, I believe. Work papers supporting statements A through P of the application.
Okay.
And it's section statement O, page 1.
It's set up the same as the application statement. So.
All right. And the application is exhibit 1.
Well, the exact.
Or is it, or you don't have the entire.
We don't have the entire. Entire application is Exhibit 1. Exhibit 1 would be just the primary pieces, the transmittal letters, and the rate schedules. It does not have all the work papers associated with it, but the application itself was filed in the proceeding.
Right. So I think this – go ahead, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
I'd like to request that the whole application be part of the record. It is the foundation of this case. And then all of this would be part of the record.
And we would have no objection to making that MDU 15 if you wanted to, the entire application, the original application is MDU 15.
The work papers.
The work
I mean, it was a separate bound set of work papers.
So just the work papers that. Be MDU 15?
Yes.
Okay, so the work papers to the application will be considered or identified as exhibit number 15 and admitted into the record as exhibit number 15.
And then if Mr. Kaufman could identify the page you're talking to her about.
It would be, it has handwritten page numbers on it, and I think it's 0-1, 0-2, 0-3, 0-4.
Thank you.
Assumed it was. Is that correct?
That
you
is
have
correct.
You have my copy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it is.
It's okay.
Penciled in the right hand corner.
And I just wanted to note the number of categories that were in each of these particular categories, and that was the only point I wanted to make. And
there were 40 separate allocation factors that we used in the embedded class cost of service study.
And I got to looking at this, I guess, because of Mr. Diller's testimony, where he notes that 34 of those 40 allocation factors are customer components. Or allocated all or in part to customer numbers. And what I wanted to ask you is to confirm, isn't it true that only 9 of those particular allocation factors are customer only?
I count 9, yes.
Okay. And 12 of those have at least some energy component?
Subject to check, I would agree there's probably some energy because of the cost of gas. So we're in the embedded class cost of service study. we're actually allocating, as I mentioned earlier, the entire revenue requirement set forth on Statement M. So there are some cost of gas expenses that are allocated on energy.
And my last question is about the demand components. I counted 22 of those 40 allocation factors that have some demand component.
Subject to check, I would agree.
So, and this is the beginning point or an important part of your class cost of service study, right, is allocating the factors to these components and then using that to decide where to fairly allocate that amongst the size customer classes, right, correct?
Between the service provided to the various customer classes, yes. It's not always size.
Right. And would it be fair to also, at least as a starting point, to use an embedded class cost of service study of this nature to decide how to apply the rate increase within the residential class? If it's fair for the, you know, dividing it amongst the classes.
There's different services provided amongst the classes. We have not taken the residential class. And again, I mentioned we do not have demographics. I would have no basis to split up a residential class except for usage. And there can be a number of reasons why that usage will vary. But at the end of the day, we have the same amount of pipeline system necessary when that customer does choose to utilize gas. If I look at, for an example, a customer with a ground source heat pump, they're not going to call on us often unless that temperature drops below what I understand to be approximately 20 degrees. Then they're calling on us, the same that they would if they didn't have a ground source heat pump. So it would, I'm not saying it wouldn't be a, it would be refinement to rate making, but we do not have the data to support why customers use more or less, and when they can, at the turn of a dial, use as much gas in this particular month or this particular year as you know, anyone else that's on that average line.
But here on Statement O, you did break out the costs for the residential class between demand, energy, and customer. Correct?
We have. We look at, you know, what the capacity-related costs are. Again, on a distribution system, those costs really don't vary. They're not variable, but they do vary by the type of customer we're serving. And if it's an interruptible service customer, that is probably the biggest differentiation that we have, is that customer is available to interrupt on those coldest days. But we do split them into those three categories.
But if you are requesting this commission to go to just the same fixed cost for every residential customer, you are treating it as if every customer that they were all customer based components, as if the incidence of customers were equally apportioned for all the costs.
For the demand costs, yes, I believe that for most customer. At one particular month, one particular season, their usage may be lower, but for the most part, that capacity is there and ready to serve those customers, is why we have looked at the demand costs as fixed costs and including them in the fixed cost, the fixed basic service charge.
Would you say that your class cost of service study is being followed at all with your proposal to go to a fixed fee within the residential class?
I believe it is. I believe that, I again believe that demand costs are not variable, and I believe that we have identified a small amount of energy costs. Those are, if you look through the study, those are associated with the cost of gas. They're load dispatching. There's some costs that do vary by the amount of gas that's moving through the system, but as noted on a per unit basis, it's only 3 cents, so
you're arguing that it's
very little.
It's just close enough for horseshoes, it's good enough, you might as well just go all the way. Is that?
Yes, to have a 3 cent distribution delivery charge, I think would not make sense to a residential customer. So I guess I don't think it makes sense to hold that small amount out on an energy basis.
Well, let's just talk theoretically about a cost, I guess, that you're considering to be fixed, but that I might consider to be variable. It cost the pipe that you might need, the distribution pipe to serve a subdivision, perhaps. Now, if it's a subdivision of very small homes, you might need a distribution line that's not as big as a distribution line to a subdivision of very large homes, right, theoretically?
Depends on the gas use of those homes.
Right. So the gas usage of those particular homes might determine the size of the pipe, and the size of the pipe might cost more.
Within the distribution system, but we're actually going, I mean, we even need to step back further than that. We need to get the gas to that distribution system. And again, even if they're a small use, it depends on what their peak day demand is. That doesn't, average annual use doesn't always equate to a lower peak day demand. Again, the ground source heat pump example is one example of that.
Well, that's an example of where your maintenance expense might be higher for some customers than others.
The pipe itself.
By usage.
The pipe installed to serve that demand. Yeah, right.
Could I get that?
Yes.
My copy?
Thank you.
Should I ask permission?
Right.
I have a few more questions about your testimony. You argue that even if the residential class goes to one basic service charge, that there will still be an incentive for conservation because the cost of gas will still be
there. Yes.
But would you agree with me that it does diminish the incentive for conservation to some degree?
I truly believe it would be a very small degree. The customer's incentive is to reduce the amount of gas that they use, which would save approximately 71% of their bill.
So you agree that to a small degree it would diminish the incentive for conservation?
You know, I really don't believe that it does. I mean, to the extent customers have the availability of using natural gas, I think what they're most focused on is reducing the gas usage in their home. They're not reducing that may change. That may change tomorrow. That, and so, again, the fixed costs associated with that system should not be our incentive to conserve.
But MDU did not perform any study that would support that claim, did it? In response to a data request, you state that MDU has not performed a study that would support whether it's possible to that your proposal would not lessen the customer's effective incentive to conserve.
I did not perform a study. I'm going again. 71% of their bill is available to conserve.
But less of the bill will be variable, so there'll be less reward for every act of conservation. Correct?
32 cents per decatherm. If we would retain the current distribution delivery charge, like every decatherm they save, they would save 32 cents. I do not think that will be the difference between someone installing more efficient equipment or making a change in how they utilize natural gas.
Just a minute. I'm going to see if I have other questions based on this, the testimony that you adopted. And I don't think I do. I think that's all the questions that I have. I appreciate your answers. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Jernigan?
One moment, please, sir.
Sure.
No questions. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Yes, I did have a couple of questions about those variable costs that might be included, and I think you answered them when you were answering Mr. Kaufman, but I still have a couple more. It's my understanding that if you are no longer going to have that distribution delivery charge, you would no longer have a weather normalization component, correct?
That is correct. There would be no need to adjust bills for weather.
Okay, and my final question does relate to Exhibit 14, and I have to apologize because I'm the one that asked the question, but I didn't quite get what I was trying to, I didn't quite convey what was in on my mind. If you retained the 32.6 cents distribution delivery charge, and I realize this is hypothetical because you might not agree to the settlement in this scenario, but if you retained it but you had the settlement dollar amount for revenue requirement, could you produce an additional column to Exhibit 14 with that scenario? Would you be willing to do that as a late-filed exhibit or perhaps for tomorrow, if we're here tomorrow?
I would agree that I could provide that number, yes.
All right.
So that would be MDU agree. Exhibit 16. It will be a late-filed exhibit updating or with an amendment to MDU Exhibit 14 showing customer service charge would look like if the distribution charge were held constant with today's charge? Is that
well, what, right? Yes, given the settlement
right.
dollar figure.
And settlement right. revenue requirement.
And one moment, please. Okay, I think that is all that we have. Thank you.
Commissioner Kolk?
I think the Chair Fedorchak has a comment.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
We were kind of thinking that before we get into our questions, maybe we should take a break.
Yeah, I think that's good. Let's come back about 10 after 3.
Perfect.
I object.
Yeah, I agree. Okay.
Guess that would go far.
That was a rule. We're referring to the
This is all really paid.
Okay, we're back on the record, and at this time we can continue with the examination of Ms. Aberle. Go ahead, Commissioner Kolk.
Thank you, Your Honor. All right, thank you, Tammy. We've done this a lot over the years, haven't we, visited about rates and costs. So I believe I understand most of what your case is, and certainly appreciate all the questions that have come from the interveners as well as others. Just a couple highlights that I want to get to the cost of service study a little eventually, but just going back on how this different customer classes are laid out, you said something that really intrigued me, that perhaps South Dakota has removed the Air Force and loaded it into a large interruptible group. It seems like that's a good idea considering the way the Air Force is privatized. How would we do that? Is that something that we could do in this rate case? Move the Air Force into just a large interruptible class, because really that's kind of what they are now.
We have some agreements in place with the Air Force that tie back to Rate 64, so I think we would need to investigate that. But they're essentially treated similar to a large interruptible class today, but they do have some uniqueness, and because we've had a longstanding agreement with the Air Force base, I guess it's certainly something that could be investigated. It's not something we've looked at here.
And I don't know that that would require a full-blown rate case to do something like that, but it just I think that seems like a reasonable idea that they're no longer the Air Force as an entity. They're privatized, and you're serving them gas, and they do their own thing with it, right?
Well, to date, nothing's really changed as far as our delivery into that system because the airbase themselves are still divvying up those costs to the customers, where in Ellsworth, they've taken that a step further. So there really is a uniqueness okay. about the base at this point in time that it may be premature to roll them in at this point in time.
So the South Dakota has taken it to the next level where they've actually broken it down by meters to different things inside the base.
They do have some metering within the base, and at this point in time there isn't any individual metering in the Minot Air Force Base, to my knowledge.
Okay, fair enough. The and the way I think I understand it is the large interruptible class, the way it is now, is approximately 7 big users. Would I know any of those? I'm sure I would. Can you give me an example of two of those 7, who they might be?
Sure. One would be the Tesoro Refinery. The largest of the group is actually an ethanol plant near Hankinson. So that's the largest of our large interruptible customers.
Okay.
On our system today.
And then a small interruptible, roughly 200 of them. So basically you're going to have your residential, your interruptibles. And explain to me again what a firm general is. How does that tie in?
Firm general service under the definition of our tariffs is a customer that is, for the most part, a commercial business. But we go a bit further and say that we don't look at end use. So actually, the apartment buildings we've been talking about under our rate structure are firm general service if they're master metered, because we're serving more than one individual unit. Our residential service is defined as service to an individual unit. So okay. Again, the apartments that are master metered are served under firm general service rate.
Well, you saw exactly where I was going with that question then. Okay, perfect. The fixed charge distribution costs we've been talking a lot about. And your one chart you had, I like how you basically lay out there that, you know, it's depending how much you use, you're going to benefit certain times a year back and forth. How much is the balance billing been able to be sold by MDU? We've talked a lot about that over the years. Are your balance billing numbers going up? Or are they staying static?
You know, the last I looked at those, they're still in that 25% range of our residential customer group. We continue to offer that, especially because even with the fixed bill or the fixed rate for distribution, that cost of gas is still going to, you know, significantly fluctuate based on winter use. So to the extent we have customers that are having difficulty, that is really our first course of action, is to be sure that they have looked at balance billing. And we promote it throughout the year in any of the materials that we provide or on the website. But I haven't seen I think with the recent decrease in gas costs, we haven't seen that uptick in customers that are actually participating. And it really works probably the best if you're a gas-only customer. If you happen to be a combination service customer of Montana Dakota, there's almost this natural right. balancing that happens as long as we have some real summer weather. So their electric bill's higher in the summer and their gas is higher in the winter. So a little bit of natural balancing that occurs. But certainly we see in the gas-only because, you know, they have a bill of $20 or less in the summer, depending if they have a water heater, and then that can rise up to $200 or dollars in the winter.
Okay.
And they have availed themselves of that program.
The earlier today we talked about the federal agencies that were involved other than the Air Force. To your knowledge, I'm sure you were part of the settlement discussion and gave your advice. Is there groups like the post office or other that will tie into these different customer classes that we should be aware of how this might change this? I'm still waiting to see how that is going to play itself out.
There are a number of customers we serve that would be part of that group as a post office. I would say for the majority of them are likely firm general service customers.
Okay.
There may be a couple out there subject to check that may have been large enough that are actually on an interruptible rate. And if they are, they'd be on the small interruptible rate. I don't believe we have, there would be none on the large. So it's really the only two places they can be served. None of those customers would qualify for residential service, so they would be in those two groups. And again, the settlement really, for the most part, when we talked Air Force, focused on that specific rate to the Air Force installation.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, though, is that you focused on the Air Force rate. But then if there's other customers that are involved in that federal agencies, wouldn't they get the rate that's agreed to in the settlement agreement?
Yes, and then, you know, I can't speak for them, but that is part of
the entire
package.
Okay, but that may cause you to get less money in it will cause you to get less money in a class than what you've anticipated, because unless you can tell me which ones they are.
The agreement is specific to Rate 64, just to the airbase.
Okay.
I mean, we have... In the agreement, we have agreed to the allocation of the increase to each of the classes. And so to the extent firm general under the settlement agreement is 0% increase, any government installation served under those rates wouldn't receive an increase. So they're covered by each of those rate classes.
Okay, so if the federal building or the post offices are not included in that listing, they're not going to benefit by the settlement agreement numbers?
They will... I mean, only if they're in firm general and 0% increase to firm general. But the decrease is just to the Air Force base.
Okay.
So that is the only decrease that was agreed to. It's a specific schedule, Rate 64.
Then all those questions that were floating out there, those other facilities, it doesn't really matter?
To me, they're one or the other. They're firm general and potentially small interruptible. But that... I believe would have been their understanding when they looked at the settlement agreement.
Okay, that didn't get flushed out this morning, so that may be something we'll circle back around to. Okay, and then this is the last line of questions. Somewhere in here, the rate 36 or 64 or sectional, where is it at again? Statement O, good Lord. Only page 1 of 36, right? Tell me how, can you get to that one slide that says... proposed settlement increased by rate class.
Sure.
Please. Okay. So if we go all the way to the right, is that the best column of where the settlement agreement is now?
On the far right-hand column is the rate of return on rate base. And so that's the overall return that class would provide if the 3.3% increase was allocated to that class.
Okay. Where can you point me to that shows how those percentages equate to the true cost of setting up the distribution fixed charge to those classes?
Well, if you look at the statement O, and if you look at the return on rate base as filed column, you see that where it says 3.4% for residential?
Right.
That, based on the class study that we filed in this rate case, which is statement O, you'll see on that page where we show return on rate base before increase, that shows that class today is producing a return of 3.4%. Which is below the overall average. So the first step is to allocate an increase to the class saying that's not sufficient. They should be providing more of a return on the investment than that. So we first allocate an increase.
No, I'm tracking all that, but I'm just looking for a simple, okay, this is how much at the end of the day will be charged to residential rates. Is this the right amount we should be charging for the cost?
And I believe that the class study shows that we're not fully there. We still haven't got fully to where, based on the class study, we believe we should be, but we're moving that direction.
Okay, is there somewhere, maybe that was Alana was talking about that in her exhibit, but is there somewhere where I could just get we need an additional 2% in residential. We're overcharging 6% in Air Force. We're undercharging in large. So I can really see what it is that we want to get to if that's where we go to. Because I get all this to a point, but it just gets blurry.
Yeah, it's a lot of no.
I mean, if that's where the position that the company wants to go to, show me a piece of paper that shows where we need to get to. Right.
Sure, I think we have that available, Staptons.
So that's going to be in your your.
It'll be PSC Exhibit 4.
Okay, and you'll walk through all that.
One of our witnesses will.
Okay.
Yes, we mitigated. I show here only the dollar amount, and that won't be helpful. But we mitigated the increase before we even designed the rates.
Okay. All right, that'll be helpful. And then the last question that I would have is it seems to me that with the volatility of gas prices now, I think it'll be volatile in the future. Some might differ about that, but Commissioner Crispin's point to how did we get here? I think you answered that very well about how in the past we didn't have things broken out, we didn't have the fuel clause adjustment, and so there's a lot of things that the commission did then to kind of make things fair based on what was happening at that point in time. But now that we know, it seems to me that we need to really figure out what is the true cost by customer group and get those costs allocated that way. But wouldn't it be better for customers, given volatility of gas prices, if there was a more stable fixed charge? Would that insulate them a little bit from some of the changes, the swings in gas prices, for as far as you as a company and the system you've got to put into place?
Well, I think it still does on those higher use months. To the extent you're stabilizing that, it's not adding to what they have to deal with in the volatility of those winter months, because again, majority of the use is space heating use, so that's really what I think causes, if it's extremely cold, they're not only paying for that cost of gas that month, that likely, I mean, in any event, what the level is, it's going to be higher because they're using more gas. They're also overpaying for what the fixed costs are to get that gas to their home.
Do you think there could be wholesale fuel switching at some point if the cost of gas gets to be so high?
Well, there's a lot of factors that, I mean, in certain groups, we've seen that in the past. And, you know, we're seeing some changes in propane prices. And certainly in the early 90s, late 80s, I mean, we saw a lot of these small interruptible customers or the interruptibles were actually utilizing propane because it was cost-effective to do. And there's a potential for electricity, but these rates are still competitive with electricity. Right. These rates would not force customers to move to electricity.
Thank you, Tammy. That was all I had.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Okay. Tammy, I've got notes and all kinds of thoughts, so hopefully this will make some sort of sense, but you'll have to just bear with me if I'm jumping all over the place. Let's start with that slide. Help me understand the last three columns. As filed, I get that. You just explained that to Commissioner Kalk, so that's what currently is occurring, right?
Based on the class study that we submitted, that is the return that class is providing, yes.
Today. With the interim rates?
No. That's pre-case.
Then tell me what settlement is.
Settlement is what we've agreed to here. So we've agreed to a revenue requirement. So we've reduced O&M. We've increased margins. And we have reduced the ROE. And those three components then reduce the amount of incremental revenues we need from 4.3 down to 2.6. So it reflects that, and it also reflects a class study where we changed an allocation factor.
But, okay, where I'm confused is you've got settlement and then with revenue increase.
Well, once we add the revenue increase in. So the settlement
is... What is settlement? What is that? Just a chart of what the settlement allows each
really
of these to
the
return?
It's allocation factor.
Okay. That's out. And then tell me why that doesn't include the revenue increase.
Well, it's a basis for how are we going to allocate. It's a step in the process. What's the class returning as a whole today? So that it helps form the basis for how you allocate the increase.
So it isn't a return on rate base?
It is. It's the return on the revenue rate base once we've added revenues.
So once you've added the revenue increase, then it's the return on rate base. But just this middle column is not the return on rate base.
No, it's what they were providing before the increase.
Okay, so the return on rate base with the revenue increase in the settlement is the final column, right up there.
If everything stayed exactly as presented, what we've said, this is our projected year, we should go back and look and perform a class study, and the residential classes should be providing a return of 6.9%.
Okay. All right. Where to go next? Let's take out the statement O.
Page one.
For those the chart that lists the 40 different allocation factors. The ARP interveners ask you a lot of questions about how you, which group you put these in each of these different allocation factors, demand, energy, or customer. Can you tell me, I'm interested in the demand and the energy allocation factors. Can you tell me, number two, peak design day at distribution? What is that, and why is that demand, and is there any part of it that's variable, or tell us why it is fixed? Why is that a fixed cost?
The factor number two is the peak day design at distribution is really how we look at the system in designing the system. If we were to, of course, it evolves over time, but it's what is the capacity that we need to have on the system in order to deliver gas
to where it needs to be on peak demand.
Yes, so we look at that on peak day demand. If every customer came on that peak day design day, we look at what would we have to design that system for, and that really goes throughout. I mean, it can start at the smallest level all the way out to the entire system. And so that's a factor that we look at. We look at what use per customer for the residential class on a normalized basis. And so they're getting that capacity necessary to serve their demands.
Okay, so that's why it's a demand.
That's why we, yes.
And why is that a fixed cost?
Well, the factor itself is allocating associated fixed costs. So once we've put the pipe in the ground, we've designed, for the most part, most systems, most subdivisions, most areas are going to be designed with a pretty standard sizing of pipe because, A, we need to be available and ready to serve that gas on that coldest day, regardless of if they add equipment, they may start out with little gas equipment. They may add gas equipment. The energy we flow through that system will vary from day to day, but the capacity of that pipe is necessary to serve those loads. And certainly it would be very inefficient to be sizing it for what is there right now today because you'd be constantly, resizing pipe, digging up pipe, putting new pipe in. So we say that those capacity-related costs or demand-related costs, which are really the cost of the system to move it from that town border station that we talked about to each of those areas. Individual customer has its own, services to their home, but this demand component is that broader distribution system.
Okay, then just to go through a few of these, number 13, distribution mains, is demand and customer.
Had proposed in the rate case is we looked at distribution mains and advocated that a portion of that main is there simply because a customer exists without any regard to what they ever use. We advocated that, and we used a 25% allocation. So we took the distribution mains account, which is by and far the largest
investment on in this case. And we said 25% of that will allocate on customers. So as we looked at before, that's going to move more of that cost to the residentials because they represent about 86% of our system. And the rest of those costs we put on demand. So we looked at what is the demand contribution from each of the customer classes. And so that's why when you look at that, it really is a summary of those factors and how they're applied, that it showed demand and customer in that factor that you just referenced.
Okay. Now, you just mentioned something that is helpful. The other classes, non-residential classes, do they pay a larger portion of the demand charges overall?
They would.
Because they don't have this fixed customer charge.
Well, they have a customer charge. It's not, at this point, is not fully fixed charge.
So when you move, for distribution mains, 75% of the total cost for distribution mains is covered under the demand charge, under demand.
We had proposed it.
Is that how it was settled?
75% was allocated on demand.
Okay. So are the large customers or some of these more commercial customers paying a bulk of that? So you're saying the residential are not paying as much?
Well, there's still the majority of our system is residential. But on a per-unit basis, I believe they would be, yes.
Okay. Let's see. Then go to distribution plant, demand, and customer.
So, again, this is what you're referring to is a summary. So as... If you look at the actual statement, what you have are the work papers there. I don't know if it, but really, as we go through and allocate, we'll highlight, mains we allocated in this manner and services we allocate on a customer factor. So on certain expenses, we look at the entire distribution plant subset and created a new factor rather than taking each of those individual. So it's really a summary of all the prior allocation factors.
Okay. Starting to get blurry, Commissioner Kalk. All right. When you go into different neighborhoods, do you size pipe based on what you think it might be by the size of the house or anything like that? Or are all the residential systems kind of sized about the same, regardless? Like, would you go to a trailer home park and size that different than you would, say, a promontory point?
My understanding is the systems are designed pretty much on an average basis. Again, not knowing what will be there in the future, what will change, it's once the cost of installing the pipe is the biggest part of the cost of what's in the distribution system. So if you have to go in a year later because you undersized that distribution system, it would be very inefficient. So for the most part, there isn't. Certainly, if you have a large commercial user, that service to that large commercial user would be designed specific to that commercial. But on a residential basis, my understanding is the design is pretty much on an average basis.
Okay. Can you say the design is on an average basis? I mean, pretty much makes it sound like there's some exceptions out there. And
my understanding is on an average.
Okay, so regardless of what kind of a neighborhood is, the system is designed basically the same.
Yes.
And the costs are the same. So the cost to build your system out to feed a new trailer home park versus a brand new ritzy neighborhood would be the same.
Well, again, per unit price of the pipe. An installation of that pipe. There may be more pipe. There may, it would depend on.
Right,
that,
but the pipe, you're, it's
per
the same
unit,
size pipe and all that.
The pipe would be
okay.
The same.
Is it possible for you to go through some scenarios on this fixed charge basis, say, just simply with me, on a customer who has a gas line to feed a single shop, say, just to feed, you know, to provide gas heat to their shop. They pay, they don't use it a lot, say they don't use a lot of gas. This is going to be, what's the impact to them of putting things to the customer charge, to a fixed charge?
Every residential customer would contribute the 200 and, if I refer back to this last slide, would contribute on an equal basis.
Okay, so their impact would be significant, right? They would pay a lot.
Well, the maximum increase is about $4.58 a month.
Okay.
To any one of those customers.
How about if you're serving apartment houses where you've got this master meter? How do those charges get?
Those are under our general service rate. So under this proposal, where we have not allocated any increase to the firm general, it's providing the overall return or close to it. And we, in fact, didn't increase their fixed charge at this time either.
So customers in residential customers in an apartment that have a master meter would not see an increase in their fixed charge?
Correct.
So that would apply to customers in, say, the Touchmark, those types of facilities?
Typically, those are all master metered, yes.
Nursing homes?
Yes.
Okay. How about trailer parks? Do those folks get service to their, is that a master meter type scenario?
I believe there's a combination with trailer parks. I would need to confer on that, but I believe there's a combination of some master metered systems yet and individual.
Okay. Let's see here. We received a fair amount of letters that I believe are part of the record from members of the AARP, and then, you know, there's been a fair amount of materials distributed from them, the interveners, just in the media, and talking a lot about the proposed increase means that even if you turn off all the gas appliances in your home, you would still owe MDU $21 per month compared to the $9 you paid them a year ago. And well, we've seen that in the settlement, it's a smaller amount. But talking about in the materials, they talk a lot about how this decreases their customers' ability to control their own costs. You talked with the AARP attorney on, and he asked a lot of questions about this component and taking away this the variable on the distribution fee. Have you figured out, and it must be somewhere in these books, what percent, so you've got 71% is the cost of gas. You take away the distribution fee, what percent of the remaining 29% is that? So you're proposing to go entirely fixed cost. What percent of the remaining that was a variable cost that the customers could control is going to be gone?
I actually haven't calculated the number, but I could quick. So what the distribution delivery component is today would be shown on this slide. So it's about the $30 is, I can't really see.
Which side is that one now?
If you go to
residential rates.
In again, in what is that exhibit? MDU 13.
Okay.
If you have the book that we provided, and if in MDU 13, it'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth page. Excuse me, sixth page. Right. It splits out the residential rate components. Again, this
okay.
Okay, so if you look at, again, this is an average customer, right. This 94 decatherms. And that, and on at average, the most that they would save if they, the distribution delivery component of that bill is $30.
So 30, whatever percentage, $30 of 730, right. 735, that's
4.2%.
Okay, so they would be losing 4.2% of their total ability to control their bill.
And again, I believe that is what is some of those communications, because under their scenario, they're using zero gas. So what are they going to conserve? I mean, to see the full amount of the increase that has been communicated, they use zero gas. So there is nothing left to conserve. They've conserved it down to zero already. But on an average basis, that would be, they would lose that $30.
So if what I'm understanding you to just say, if they're not arguing with the revenue need, now there's still some other issues with how it's distributed with between the classes, but if they're not arguing with the revenue need, then every customer is going to need to pay an increase of some sort. And you're suggesting this mechanism, and they're suggesting that this variable rate not be taken away.
Correct.
Okay. Does it cost you less to run your system in the summer?
No.
The exact same?
Yes.
Okay. You don't do any breakdown of your residential customers, like by use, or you can't break them down further than just their residential customers?
I can provide a breakdown based on if we took a point in time, a period, last 12 months or...
But what kind of categories can you break them into?
Just usage. That really is all that I know what they used based on what we billed to them in the last 12 months, the last calendar year. We do not...
So it would be like an address and a use. I mean, what categories would you break? Here's, highest users would be, how would you describe them?
I'd have to look at every bill or every customer account in that if we chose a group. I mean, that we do not carry, if you will, again, demographics on our customers.
You don't have any demographics?
No.
So it's just their address?
And it would be essentially their address, yes.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, I think that's all for now, Tammy. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman.
Okay, for 2 months I was going to really come after somebody on that distribution delivery charge, but now you explained that so well, I don't have much left here. thank you for that explanation, though. I want to get back to the discussion you were having with Mr. Coughlin on volumetric versus fixed rates and the impact on low and fixed income people versus those who aren't on fixed incomes. And I'm still trying to get past, so we've determined that this plan would have more of an impact on low gas volume users than on high gas volume users, correct?
Yes, because they don't, if we use a zero use, it's $4.58, right. Yes.
So what I'm trying to figure through, I mean, it seems, the first instinct seems logically, yes, the low and fixed income people are probably in some older, more moderately sized homes and less square footage, so they would be the low volume users. But I would think that many times the higher income people with newer, larger homes also have more efficient water heaters, more efficient furnaces, better quality doors and windows and insulation and siding. And so who actually are the high volume gas users? Are they the large square footage homes, or are they the homes with older appliances and insulating features?
Commissioner, and that is, I will only be able to look back on my own personal experiences and what, you know, just in working in this area for so long, we do not have the information to say that, you know, as you described, the larger, more potentially more efficient home is actually using more gas. You know, if you look at many and folks in less insulated homes, my own grandmother would have it much hotter in that home than I ever could have stood. I mean, so again, it's just personal experiences. But my point is, I don't know that we can make that correlation. I mean, people use gas, natural gas, for different reasons, for different end uses, and I don't know that there's a necessarily an income correlation that we can derive. I just, again, if you look at it as the service necessary for them to use that gas upon demand, I don't believe that should be factor into our decision as to how we collect the costs. To date, we've not had, you know, income-related rates. You know, I believe, you know, the phone, you see communication industry, some other industries. But to date in North Dakota, we have not gone to looking at, you know, some different differences in our customer groups and trying to help them. There are programs available to help those customers, and those are federal programs that are available, the low-income energy assistance program, energy assistance. Again, those programs are funded by all of us and are there and ready to assist those customers.
Okay. Then the really dramatic number was the example of the person that uses no gas, and it was a 30-some percent increase. I would presume that someone who uses no gas is probably using some kind of alternate heating source like wood or electricity or something. But if you use no gas, if you've discontinued that, because you once signed up and in this case MDU put in the lines and the meter, are you stuck with it for life, or can you have that disconnected?
You could call. They could call tomorrow. We have no hold on them. But for whatever reason, they've either decided they will use gas in the future and they want it to remain available. But again, no. There's no minimum contract service for any of our services.
So it's not like the renewable dumpsters where you pay the same whether you use it a lot or a little or not at all. You can get rid of it.
You can get rid of it.
Okay. Then,
or if you hide it in the back of your house.
Yeah. On the settlement, on page 2, for small interruptibles, if I'm understanding the chart right, the revenue increase is a little over $369,000, and that's a 6.8% increase. So doing the math backwards, I concluded that there must be a little over $5.4 million in revenue from small interruptibles, and 8% of that equals $369,000.
And the small interruptible group is a combination of sales and transportation service customers, and we've grouped them in one group there. So the transportation service are buying their own gas and using our system to transport that gas into. So the revenue increase is skewed some. I mean, the math on that is skewed somewhat, because some of those customers' total bills are higher because there's gas costs included in there as well. But the revenue, your math is correct, is $5 million.
Okay. Well, then when I jump to the to the settlement, on the same chart, if I start with that same 5.433 million, this just doesn't come out. Either if it's $340,000 increase, that would only be about 6.25%. If it's 6.78% and the other one was 6.8%, well, you've only reduced that revenue increase by $1,000 or so.
We held the small interruptible at the same increase.
Well, how come one says 369 and one says 340? It'd be page 5.
We changed the total revenues for the small interruptible class. So, as I described, we moved the under the market-based rate. That was never included in the rate case. It's been until
that was one of the original adjustments.
Yes.
Okay.
Finally went on with me.
Now I understand that. Okay. I have no other questions. Thank you, Tammy.
Mr. Kuntz, follow-up questions?
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Saverly, you had presented a discussion a little bit about the evolution of a rate design over time from being a fully bundled rate to where we are today. Are you familiar with a declining block rate?
Yes, I am.
And was that a rate format that the company had used in the past?
Yes, it was. Declining block rates were utilized in order to capture more of the fixed costs in those in the lower blocks. So as it was a way of collecting fixed costs without going to a full fixed cost charge.
So in a way, what we now call the fixed charge or customer charge was captured in those initial increments of use. Is that correct?
They were. I mean, again, not fully, but it was more of the fixed costs, yes.
If we were to go to an embedded cost of service study for the residential within the residential customer class and set rates based upon a solely volumetric basis for customers within the residential class, what would that rate design look like for a small customer versus a large customer?
Well, I believe if under our basis that those are fixed costs, one would have a higher unit charge than the other. But then the smaller customer, if we put those into a group, would have a higher unit charge than the larger customers.
So the more gas you use, the less your rate would be, correct?
Correct.
So on a unit or per decatherm basis, a customer using 50 decatherm would pay a higher rate for that 50th decatherm than the customer who was using 150 decatherm.
Correct.
And hypothetically here, if we have a subdivision with two houses sitting side by side, and for whatever reason we have a larger household in one and the other is using a smaller house with geothermal or they go south for the winter or whatever reason, there's a substantial usage difference between one house versus the other's house in the same subdivision. Would we know that when we put the system in terms of how we design that system?
No, again, we would not design for a specific end use at that point in time.
So the investment that we have to serve those two houses sitting side by side is going to look exactly the same?
Yes.
Same size service lines going into the house?
Yes.
Same size meters, correct?
Yes.
O&M expenses basically the same for both houses?
Yes.
Billing costs are the same whether they're using one decatherm or 10 decatherm a month?
Correct.
We still do leak surveys for both houses even if one's not using gas and the other's using a lot of gas?
Yes, we do.
If you look out there, can you tell me what costs we would avoid for that household that's not hardly using any gas versus the household next door that's using a lot of gas?
The only cost we've identified in the study is some low dispatching costs, which is really we've allocated on a variable basis, and I think in the study was about 3 cents per decatherm, so very little.
And as I understand, there is no increase proposed for the firm general class, correct?
Correct.
And generally, so apartment dwellers, multiple unit facilities will generally be billed under that firm general class?
Yes.
So if there's any elderly persons living in apartments or assisted living or any of those type of multiple unit arrangements, there's no increase proposed for those customers, correct?
Correct.
If we were to take the AARP's proposal of spreading this increase across all customer classes, we would in essence be proposing an increase for those persons living in those multiple unit dwellings, would we not?
Yes.
That we're not proposing under the company's or the settlement proposal.
Correct.
I want you to turn. You had a slide up there for the proposed settlement increase by rate class. Can you find that? Maybe it was just me, but I was getting confused about the couple of the columns there on the third group. As filed, you've got a percentage number there that you show the return for each of those customer classes as the company filed it, correct?
Correct.
And that was based, if I understand it, upon your or the company's determination of what the revenue requirement for that particular class was, correct?
It's an allocation of the costs.
Right.
So without any incremental revenues.
All right. So based just as it exists today, without the interim increase, this is the return we would be getting under current rates for each of those classes.
Correct.
Okay. The next column, if I understand it correctly, this is what that would return would look like for those classes after you make some of the revenue adjustments for getting the revenue increase, but, for example, the reallocation of more revenues from a particular class because of more customers in that class.
Right.
Or a reduction in expenses, for example, for insurance for that particular class. Or the pension expenses. After you take all those things into account that are addressed in the settlement, then that second column there under return on rate base, that's what the returns would look like, correct?
Correct.
So basically then the residential class under current rates as the way we filed it with the revenue requirement for that class is 3.4%, but if you make the revenue and expense adjustments to that class, the return increases to 4.7%.
Correct.
So now to get the company to a rate of return of 9.5%, we need some additional revenues, $2.5 million, correct?
Correct.
So if we allocate those as proposed, that gets us the final column?
Correct.
Do we have the capability at this point to meter residential customers based upon demand?
We do not at this time.
So, for example, in your class cost of service study, there was a dollar amount associated with demand for residential customers. If you had the capability, you could meter on that basis?
You would know, but again, that's going to be affected by usage.
Right.
And so, again, we're looking, the reason we use an allocator based on the design day is to be able to serve that load on a peak day.
That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Okay. Mr. Jernigan?
Just a couple, and I'm hoping I can help out a little bit with the understanding of how our rate specifically works, as Commissioner Kalk has a couple of questions on that case. As you mentioned before, there are two rates that actually service Minot services, 65 and 64, correct?
Correct.
And 65 is what you call the privatized contract,
privatization of Mountain Crest.
Yes.
So prior to 2008, that contract was not in existence, and that rate was not in existence, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so prior to 2008, you were simply providing gas along your transmission lines connecting up to our distribution system, and that's where your service ended.
Correct.
And after 2008, you purchased on contract with the Air Force Base the distribution system on the base.
Correct.
And when you purchased that system on the base, the costs involved with that, you actually entered into a contract not to put that distribution base into your rate base, correct?
Correct.
It is not in your rate base.
No. It is in our rate base, but we look at it as a, if you will, a miscellaneous revenue. The
O&M goes in there.
Yes.
But if you had to put in an upgrade into the system or had to actually build more onto the system, that gets charged directly to the base, correct?
Correct.
That doesn't go into the grand scheme of everybody else's
correct.
System.
It would correct. Be a real, you know, a review of that contract.
Right. So when you're talking about the special aspects of the Air Force's rates as opposed to your average general large consumer, that might be one of the differences you're considering is how all of those interact together.
Yes.
Correct. Okay. Hoping I got close to getting things a little bit clearer there. Just a moment. Okay. And so when we're looking at the numbers that you have on the board here, these you said were for the rate 64, correct?
Correct.
So these are not the distribution system on the base. This is the cost of getting gas to the base.
Correct.
Okay, and so the rate of return I see up there is, you've got a 55.9, and 33.6. That's what you're returning, just getting it to the system, or along the system to us, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Yes, we have a couple. The first one, since we are just still looking at that slide with the returns noted, and I know staff, I believe staff is going to be testifying to this, but I think right now, if you could tell me, if you know, those numbers, the 3.4 or the 4.7, et cetera, if those numbers were going to be, if every class was returning the perfect amount to meet the return that you're entitled to, what would that number be?
What I don't have with me is what it would be under the settlement. I only have what it would be under the as-filed with me here today.
We'll wait for staff then, because I think they might have it.
Yep, I didn't.
And that's fine. I just wanted to show the
I have it, but I don't have an exhibit I could provide it.
Well, I just thought you could, if you have the number, just give the answer. So the commissioners can see the lower compared to what and the higher compared to what. But if not, we'll just wait because I think Mike is going to be talking about it. And we can go on to a couple other questions.
So for residential.
What page are you referring to?
It isn't in anywhere in there. It is a calculation based on the settlement revenue requirement. The residential increase would be 3.92%. Versus
not the increase, but the actual return number.
All
what would the return
would
number
be 7.3%, the number on the bottom of the page. I'm sorry.
Okay. So if they were all 7.34, there wouldn't be any under recovery or over recovery.
Correct.
Correct?
Sorry.
Okay. And I think we'll hear a little more about that when staff gets up. The other thing I wanted you to explain, if you know, and I'm not asking you to go outside your area of expertise, but I think the record needs to be clarified if possible. For the apartments for residential customers, I mean residential people, not necessarily customers of MDU, that are in apartments that are master metered, can you explain how, if you know, how those residents of those apartments pay for their gas? Do they pay MDU anything directly?
No, they do not.
So the landlord?
Between the landlord or the property manager and those tenants.
Okay, so when there was a little bit of discussion about whether there would be an increased customer charge coming through to them, there is no bill coming from MDU, correct? To that,
only to the
to that
property
apartment.
Owner. Or the
But not to the resident?
Not to the resident.
Okay. So if the property owner's bill changes, then it is between the property owner and his tenants as to how that tenant ends up paying any change in that bill or whether that tenant gets any reduction in a bill. Is
correct.
That correct? Is your understanding?
That is my understanding.
Okay. That's all I have. Thanks.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of follow-ups to my colleagues had some good questions that prompted some other ones. The we've talked a lot about electricity reserve margins in other proceedings, but what's the reserve margin that you plan for gas, like when your peak days? Do you have any planning figure? We talked a little bit about that. I'm just curious what you use.
On the gas side, we look at we look at a rolling 30-year average of coldest weather, what our current capacity is. And on our system or what we've contracted, I couldn't tell you what that effect is, but that's essentially how that's planned for.
Do you have any guess? I'm just trying to wrap my head around, like, how much the average day is to what might the peak day be if it's a 50% difference in gas, if it's...
Oh, there would be a significant differential between those two. Again, I don't have that number with me. Or
I don't think it's tied into so much for the rate case. I'm just curious just about how much it can ebb and flow, mm-hmm. just out of curiosity. The on the cost of new services, I've had discussion with Garrett a lot about developers paying their fair share. How is that working now? If somebody wants to develop a brand new neighborhood, MDU, I understand, it doesn't pay much early. It's up to the developers to pay early. How does that work?
Under our gas extension agreement, we look at what we reasonably believe will be filled in that subdivision. If it's a brand new development without much history, even in regard to the developer, oftentimes they would collect the amount up front in the form of a customer advance. And then if those customers do come on and we review those over 5 years, and then a refund is available to them. In the rate case process, those customer advances actually reduce our rate base,
right,
so that other customers aren't paying for that investment that's covered by the advance we have from the developer.
Okay, and so do you have just a guesstimate of how much money that you may coming back for as developers get their areas developed? How do you figure that in? You must have some kind of true up there.
And, in a rate case process, we're trying to say we believe this is an average and a projected test period, so we don't actually have a true up, if you will. We do with the developer, but that would, depending on the magnitude of it, may cause us to come back for a rate case or...
Or the other way around.
Or the other way around.
Okay, fair enough. And then you made a comment about there's no contract that someone can just disconnect their services. But I can't remember if it was you or Xcel. If someone decides to game it, and I'll say that because that's what I think they would do, where they decide to just cut off their services in May, and then I'm hooked back up again in August or September, can they do that?
They can. We do charge a reconnection fee if they choose to do that, and we'll actually charge the basic service charge for the months not in service.
Okay.
I believe, the conversation with Commissioner Chrisman was if they're a zero-use customer for 12 months, I mean, supposedly they're not coming back, but they could disconnect.
Right, and when does that reconnect drop off?
We look at it in a 12-month basis.
12-month basis, yes. Okay. And then, let's see here. The last thing I had was just as we go forward with the customer service and building all these new apps and all that, the ways to educate the customer on ways to change their behavior to save energy, I assume that can be part of these new programs that you roll out?
Yes, and we do some of that through the website today, and we include inserts in trying to always educate customers as to you know, the value of gas along with the value of conserving that natural gas. Got but it. We can certainly continue to.
Well, and one of the challenges will be electricity. You can change your behavior. You can dry your clothes different times a day. You can gas. It's cold. You're going to want your heat, so it'll be a little more challenging there. But I think it's this is. I wasn't sold there in the beginning, but I think everybody's moving to this, and so it's got to be a good idea, right? So, thank you, Tammy.
Yes,
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Couple more questions, Tammy. Mr. Diller's testimony, he talks about why not apply the straight fixed variable to other classes, customer classes. Can you tell us why this approach works well for residential and why it doesn't work for other classes and similar charges are calculated for some of the other classes?
I believe that just the diversity alone in that firm general service class, so it's every customer that isn't a residential end use all the way up to a small interruptible. So that there certainly is a lot more. It's not all weather driven necessarily. There's a lot of diversity in those customers' needs. There's much more significant cooking or water heating, and so many of them just by the larger use would be contributing more to those demand costs. But there's a lot of diversity in the firm general to, if you will, come up with one fixed charge rate. Whereas the residential.
So the diversity requires you to provide different backbone to them?
The backbone wouldn't necessarily, but their services would be different, services into the facility, whereas a residential service and certainly a commercial area would have a different size piping than just a pure residential development would.
So you can't identify what the fixed charge would be for those? Like what the basic charge
really
would
the
be.
Best way would be to demand meter those types of customers.
And is that what you do?
Well, we don't today. Today we have no demand metering present on the gas system. It's not widely used in the gas industry, but I think that we're going to see more of it. I think with some of the network information we have available today, we can move more into that demand metering, such as you see on the electric side.
So how do you set the customer charge for those, for, say, firm general?
We utilize the class study and look at the customer component and look toward what the demand costs are, trying to cover a combination of getting those customers, a portion of the demand plus the customer.
Okay. And then I missed this earlier. I should ask you. But in your original application and in the settlement, you really just focus on the two classes for increasing and for recovering this new revenue requirement. And it's a pretty significant deviation from commission tradition to not spread it across more. So, and I'll ask Mr. Diller the same, but give me your best summary as to why that is justified.
Well, I believe in prior cases we have looked at that class setting, and it's not been across the board increase. If we continue to do an across the board increase to all classes, we'll continue to have the various returns that you see on the slide up right now. We'll never move off of that. And so to
maybe
the extent,
not across the board, but smaller, incremental, but everybody pays some.
And with the large interruptible customers today, they're paying, it based on the class study, they're paying more than their fair share today. And there is also, with those customers in particular, there's always more of a threat, if you will, or a likelihood that to the extent too many of the costs get loaded onto those customers, they have alternatives. And to the extent they bypass us directly, and that has happened in the past, they choose to go directly to the pipeline, cut out the distribution company, then those residential and firm general lose that revenue stream that helps to recover those costs, you know, that don't go away because that customer went away. So I think we have to be cognizant of that. And I think again, moving toward more of a cost-based rates minimizes the subsidies between those classes.
All right. Thank you.
I have no other questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kuntz, anything?
Nothing further.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaufman?
No more questions. Thank
okay. Mr. Jernigan?
No, sir.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No questions, thank you.
Okay. Commissioners, anything further? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Aberle. Mr. Kuntz, anything further at this time from...
Yeah,
okay. Well, it's about 4:25. I'll ask the commissioners, I guess, if they have a preference. Do we want to start in with advocacy staff case and try to get through one witness, or does it make more sense to just wait and do their whole case tomorrow morning? Any thoughts?
I'd prefer to wait, personally, but okay. I would, if I'm outnumbered...
I'm with you, Madam Chair.
Okay. We'll wait until tomorrow to begin with advocacy staff case. Before we go off the record, though, are there any preliminary or any, you know, pending issues that we need to address at this time? Mr. Kuntz, anything?
None from the company.
Okay. Mr. Hsu, anything?
I have handed out exhibit, PSC Exhibit 5, and I would just request that everyone stipulate for that to be admitted into the record.
Have all counsel seen the PSC?
We have no objection.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman, Mr. Jernigan?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I don't know if I've seen 5. Sorry. If it's here. And I probably don't have, oh, thanks. No, I have no objection.
All right. PSC Advocacy Staff Exhibit Number 5 will be admitted into the record at this time as well. Mr. Hsu, anything else?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman? Mr. Jernigan?
No, sir.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Nothing, thanks.
If I could just ask Alana real quickly, though, I don't know that there's a need for that late-filed exhibit we were talking about with the breakout of all those different other groups in the federal agency. I think we cleared that up enough, unless mm-hmm. you want it. I don't need it.
Yeah, I know. Thank you, Your Honor, Mr. Commissioner, because that would be helpful, because that is not going to be an easy undertaking either. You know, it would require our cooperation to try to search through our customer base to try to identify those agencies and the locations, and they're all going to be in that firm general class in all likelihood. Anyway.
Well, I just ask Alana to. I don't have a need for it like I thought I did, but she's a general counsel.
Well, I think if we know now what class they're in, then that's what we needed to know.
Yeah, so I don't, unless
Thank
my
you.
Colleagues would need that.
I don't.
Yeah, that's a question I had as well. So there's no longer a need for Mr. Jernigan to produce either the short list that was discussed earlier or the more extensive late filed exhibit. That's what we're saying?
That's what I see, I guess.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
That's okay. All right, I guess.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Kuntz.
The witnesses that MDU has presented, could we ask that they be excused from the hearing for tomorrow? I mean, some of them will likely be here in the hearing room, but there may be some that have other commitments if they can be excused.
Mr. Hsu, any objection to that?
No objection to that, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaufman?
No objection.
Mr. Jernigan?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Okay.
Commissioners, no problem with that?
Keep Tammy around.
Tammy right. better stick
yeah,
around.
I'm sure Tammy will be one of those that will be here.
All right.
Travis might want to stay close.
With the exception of Ms. Aberle, if she'll be available, the others could be excused. And we'll go off the record for today. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
9 a.m.